The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
81 Monday.
12 minutes after 8 at the Bill Myers Show. And in studio, we have a couple of people I wanted to let you know a little bit more about. And first off, we have Diane Cowan. Hello, Diane. It's good to have you in here this morning.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And you represent what? The Philanthropic Education Organization.
Yes.
Right? PEO.
Yes.
And you're having a great fundraiser this weekend. It's going to be featuring this friend of the show who we've talked to off and on for years, Bob Hayworth, formerly. Now, are you still with the Kingston Trio or are you formerly?
Formerly. Yes. So I don't travel anymore.
Okay. But he still has his banjo ukulele.
I brought it along.
Yeah, doing sort of things. And I want, because you're doing a big fundraiser, this is going on tomorrow.
Yes, right? It is.
And before we get into this fundraiser, what is it about the Philanthropic Education Association? What do you do? You raise money in order to give scholarships, but specifically for what?
For higher education for women, and actually all kinds of education. It can be either at the college level. It can be one of our scholarships we give to a graduating high school senior at mm-hmm. Ashland High School. There are all kinds of things. We have one scholarship that is for international students who it's our Peace Scholarship, and mm-hmm. they come here for graduate work, but with the understanding they sign documentation that they're going to take this expertise back to their own country.
Oh, okay. How many scholarships have you given out over the years? Do you have a count on that?
Internationally or our local chapter?
Yeah, both, if you don't mind.
Internationally, we've given out, 432 million dollars in educational assistance over the years.
That's some real money. That's real money. Okay.
And we have, our chapter kind of concentrates on this area. Mm-hmm. So we have had... we sponsored students in Ashland, Talent, Phoenix, Medford, Central Point, White City, and Klamath Falls.
Yeah, we're not talking government loans. These are just grants, scholarships
are
going in there. Okay, that's very good. And so you have partnered then with Bob.
Yes,
over
we
here.
Have. we all have experienced Bob's music, and we all had such a good time. And we thought, well, this would be a fun way for us to let PEO be known and make some money for our local scholarships.
And this is going to be going on tomorrow, Saturday the 12th, 3 till 5:30.
Yes.
At the Tolman Creek Grange. Well, the Bellevue Grange. Bellevue Grange.
On Tolman Creek.
Yeah. Now, you played there before, Bob?
Yeah, we played there a couple of times.
So. Okay. And you're going to be playing along with John Hollis. Now,
yes.
John
uh-huh.
Hollis, of course, most famously, we would know him when he would be up at Callahan's.
He did that for 19 years up there. He was the house musician.
Okay, so you're both going to be, what kind of songs will you be performing, let's say?
Well, we call this Hootenanny Saturday Night. And so what it is, and some people say, well, what the heck hootenanny mean? But back in the 50s, people used to get together to sing folk music, mm-hmm. and they called that a hootenanny, a gathering of people. So we're getting people together, and we're going to lead the singing along, and hopefully the songs we pick are going to be stuff that people remember.
Singing along, you'll be in the Grange, the Bellevue Grange, very good. And how much does it cost, Diane?
It's $25 a ticket.
So this is just all to take care of these scholarships funds here in Southern Oregon.
Yes.
And it's going on tomorrow, 3 to 5:30. Now, the doors open at 2:30.
Yes.
And there's also going to be a dessert. Then,
yes. Homemade cookies.
Homemade cookies. All right. Hey, very good. So, Bob, you want to tune up the... I don't know if you can tune up the ukulele.
I don't know. This thing never gets in tune. But, we're going to be doing folk music from the Weavers, the Kingston Trio, Brothers Four, uh-huh. Peter, Paul, and Mary, all the groups that had hits during the late 50s and 60s, what we call the folk music scare.
And, the scare?
That's what I call it.
Oh, okay. Or else
it almost caught on.
The leftists are taking... No, I...
That's right. That well, actually, a lot of that was. There was, Pete Seeger was called in front of committees about his communist leanings. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the music, in fact, the song I'm going to play a little bit of was kind of communistic. Yeah. But we don't advertise that.
No, that's fine. That's all right, but still, good tunes. Go ahead and roll one.
Yeah,
just a quick one, okay?
This is an example. This land is your land. Sing along.
This land is my land. From California
to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Oh, this land was made for you and me.
There we go. And just a quick example. So you and Bob Hollis both.
John Hollis, pardon me,
trading off there. And this is all the money going for this, or how does that work?
It's all going to go for scholarships.
Okay, all going for scholarships.
All of our profit.
All right, all your profit. Well, yeah, you got to pay for the rain.
You got to
cookies.
I know you got to do that. So you need lots of people to show up, have a good time, good sing-along, great music, great fellowship, and for a good cause, too.
Yes.
I would dare add.
And it's really fun. We've decided it's part of our education effort, because when we decided we were going to have a hootenanny, half of the people of a certain age said, oh, hootenanny, that's great.
Now, I know, I wasn't even sure what a hootenanny was.
That's the other half of the people.
Oh, okay, so tell me what the hootenanny is then.
Well, it's just exactly what Bob just said.
Okay, all right.
We're going to sing along, play the old music, and have fun.
All right, very good. Good fellowship there, too.
And it's usually songs that everybody knows.
Yeah, do you have to get tickets in? Now, tickets are $25.
Yes.
You know, for this. And remember, this is a fundraiser tomorrow.
Yes.
1050 Tolman Creek Road at the Bellevue Grange tomorrow, 3 till 5:30. And do you have to buy tickets in advance, or can you just show?
We have been selling tickets in advance. At this point, if people just show up, we have a limit on how many people we can have at the Grange. So it's first come, first served at this point.
All right. Once again, the Philanthropic Education Organization.
Yes.
The Hootenanny Fundraiser.
Yes.
Tomorrow afternoon here in Southern Oregon.
We hope to see everybody there to have a good time.
I really appreciate you stopping by here.
All right. Okay?
Thank you for,
Thanks for having us.
All right. Good to see you. Nice meeting you. Once again, Diane Cowan, Bob Hayworth. Always good talking with you, Bob.
Thanks, Bill.
You're always welcome. Okay.
All right.
Take care. It's 19 minutes after 8.
This hour of the Bill Myers Show is sponsored by 290 AF Rogue River in South Jackson County on 106.7 K294 AS Ashland.
A lot going on this weekend, and certainly probably the biggest event of all here in Southern Oregon would be Pear Blossom. This is the weekend, and of course, Darcy Mansell, who is kind of busier than a proverbial one-legged man in a butt-kicking contest here. She's racing around with a cell phone. Hey, Darcy, just wanted to check in with you from Pear Blossom and get what the lay of the land is for this weekend. What can we expect?
Oh, my gosh, it's so exciting. So right now we're building the miniature city downtown, so all the food vendors have come in. We're putting in all the other vendors now. So the street fair runs Friday from noon to about 10 p.m. tonight. We've got music starting at 5 o'clock, and we've got the street fair tomorrow as well. It opens around 10 in the morning, and it goes till 6 tomorrow night. And we've got music all day tomorrow as well. Of course, we've got the Pear Fair tent, which is on the corner of 5th and Central, and we've got 30 vendors in there for wine, beer, cider, artisan food tasting in there. And we've got the Smudge Pot Stroll tonight, which is sold out, of course, and where you stroll downtown and sample appetizers and drinks. And, of course, the parade starts tomorrow at 11, and it comes down Central, turns right onto East Main. And we've got over 100 entries in the parade again this year, and a lot of fun floats.
And I think you're going to have great turnout on this one, because the weather is going to be about as good as you can get for a pear blossom. And you and I have done these parades before, and we talk about how, you know, there have been years that you've been baked, there have been other years you've been fried, other years you've been frozen. It's going to be kind of just right, isn't it? Really?
Yes. It's going to be perfect weather for it, for all the animals that are in the parade, and as well as our volunteers, and as well as for the pear blossom runners, too.
Yeah. What kind of economic impact does a pear blossom have here in Southern Oregon? Do you have any way you can kind of put a bean on that?
We've got, including the run, we've got 10 different events that we bring into town for a four-week period. And we bring in people from as far away. We've got food vendors here that come from as far away as Washington. Mm-hmm. We've got food vendors from California. We've got actual vendors from Arizona that have handmade items. We've got a cornhole tournament on Saturday, and teams come from anywhere from Reading up to Portland. So we bring in a lot of people and a lot of tourism from outside for all the different events that we do.
How many people does it take to actually put this on, Darcy?
You know, we've got a 10-member all-volunteer board that actually plans, organizes, and implements the 9 events that we put on. Of course, the Pear Blossom Run is done by the YMCA.
Mm-hmm.
All told together, when you include the run, Volunteer-wise, it takes over 500 volunteers every year.
A lot of people, and you're busy scurrying around. So today, though, is Street Fair Day. It's when that kicks off, 12 noon, right?
Yep, and Para Fair as well. And Para Fair opens at 3.
Yeah, what about the parking availability? Where would you suggest if you were, you know, heading down, you know, to that area? Because is it just going to be the parking garage you would suggest, or maybe
parking? You can do the parking garage. Yeah, you can do the parking garage. Mm-hmm. Any of the side streets are usually available to park in as well, and then just walk a couple blocks in. And the public parking that's down below what used to be in at the Commons as well.
Okay. All right. Very good. And it's just good to know. And if you were actually there to set up for the parade, let's say tomorrow, how early should people show up, you think, to get the best slot? Get spot?
I would say around 9. Okay. If I'm going up and down the streets on parade morning, around 9 to get your good spot. And the judges stand, of course, is right across from the Para Fair tent on 5th and Central. And then we do the live TV coverage on East Main, on the corner of East Main and Central. And we've got speakers up there as well, so you can hear what the entries are about, and at both spots.
I know you're going to have a great event. You always put on a great event here, Darcy. Darcy Manself with the Pear Blossom. And once again, you can get all the information, pearblossomparade.org. And I love your phone number, too, 541-840-PEAR, P-E-A-R. All right. Be well and have a wonderful weekend. Thank you, Darcy. Take care.
Thank you, Bill. Bye.
Bye-bye. Darcy Manself from Pear Blossom, going to be a big, big deal here in Southern Oregon. 827. Another big deal here I have for you right now, a $20 gift certificate in my, you know, semi-chubby hand, and that is for the Diner 62 Real American Quiz. I would like to give that to you right now if you can win this quiz question. We have a great quiz question, and it has to do with Martin Luther King Jr. Multiple choice, and if you get it, $20 gift certificate from Diner 62. I got to tell you, the breakfast that they deliver here, the ham and cheese and omelet that I had delivered last week was like, once again, in heaven, I hope there's a slot that I can just put an order in and just say, I want that Diner 62 cheese omelet, okay? And so many other things, too. 2 pork chops and eggs, or 8-ounce New York steak and eggs on special right now on the weekends. And remember, today, Clam Chowder Friday. And they also have a half ham special for $11.15 Monday through Friday. Right now, you can scurry over there before 9 o'clock. And they'll give you that special, too. 770-5633. Let's have some fun. Do the Diner 62 quiz next.
When customers...
You're hearing the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
Diner 62 Real American Quiz. And we have Melinda here, hoping to win that. Sounds pretty good, doesn't it, Melinda? Welcome.
It sure does.
Okay. Melinda, it was tomorrow in history. April 12th, 1963, Good Friday, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. arrested, thrown in jail for a campaign of protests, marches, and sit-ins in Birmingham, Alabama. The actions were orchestrated with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and their partners in the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights. Started over a little week earlier, and then they kept on protesting, and then we had an injunction obtained by, Eugene Bull Connor. Pretty much a notorious pro-segregation guy, all right? And his forces employed against the other Birmingham protesters that summer, too. It was pretty wild. So Martin Luther King Jr. is thrown in jail after all of this drama here. The question, who paid the $160,000 bail to get Martin Luther King Jr. out of jail? Was it A, the NAACP? Was it B, the United Auto Workers? Was it C, the Republican State Central Committee? D, Arthur G. Gaston, or was it E, AFSCME, you know, that union, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees? It was one of those five. You want to take a stab at that?
Yeah, I'm going to have to. Number four,
Arthur D. Gaston. Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry about that, Melinda. Let me go to Lauren. Hey, Lauren, how you doing this morning?
I'm doing okay, getting my walk about finished up here.
All right, so here we go. Let's talk about NAACP, United Auto Workers, Republican State Central Committee, or ask me, who paid Martin Luther King Jr.'s bail to get him out of Birmingham jail?
I'm going to go with the Republican State Committee.
Republican State Committee. No.
No.
I am sorry, Mayor Lauren. I know you're hungry on that walk. Let me go to Vicky. Hi, Vicky. How you doing?
Hey, how's it going?
All right. I'm fine. Well, I'm checking this off. So Who paid Martin Luther King Jr.'s bail? Was it NAACP, United Auto Workers, or Ask Me, that union? What do you say?
I'm going to say the auto workers.
The auto workers. It's a good day for you. Yes. As Martin Luther King Jr. sat in a solitary jail cell without even a mattress to sleep on, he started to pen a response to his critics, and that letter became known as Letters from a Birmingham Jail, offered a full-throated defense of the Birmingham protest campaign. The United Auto Workers paid King's $160,000 bail, and he was released from jail on April 20th, over a week later. Now, 4 months later, he gave that I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, regarded by many as the high watermark of his movement. A year after that, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which guaranteed voting rights and outlawed segregation and racial discrimination in all sorts of places. By the way, Democrats split their vote on that, by the way, 152-96, while Republicans split theirs, 138-4 to 34% no. And the no vote, by the way, 74% Democrats, kind of an interesting little bit of political data. Okay. So, Vicki, enjoy Diner 62. Hang on. I'll get you all set up. We'll have another Diner 62 quiz early next week on The Bill Maier Show. News is coming up, and then we're going to be talking about voting again, except this time, how do we make our votes more honest with the Honest Elections Project? We'll talk with those people.
One of each, K4 VIN 016551, MSRP 24145, Telluride VIN 624073, MSRP 44735, $59.99, due 10K miles per year, zero security deposit, all incentives and discounts to dealer plus tax, title license, 150 registration processing fee, trading in a vehicle will not eliminate your debt. Negative equity applied to new loan balance ends 4/30/25.
Get up and go to
KIA.com/CWP.
Good morning. This is News Talk 106.3 KMED. And you're waking up with the Bill Maier Show.
We've got a lot of focus on trying to reform the way elections are done. Of course, in the state of Oregon, it's been kind of challenging. We know that illegal aliens even got access and registered to vote just part of signing up for their driver's license. There was an act passed by Congress this week, the SAVE Act, and I wanted to talk with Jason Sneed about that. Jason Sneed is the executive director of the Honest Elections Project Action. Jason, great to have you back on. Morning, sir.
It's great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Great. Can you tell me what the SAVE Act does first off, and what is its legislative status first, and then we'll maybe go on to what it actually does?
Sure. So the SAVE Act is a bill that just passed in the House of Representatives yesterday, and it requires a very basic thing, proof of citizenship before somebody can get registered to vote and added to the voter rolls. So right now, the way the system works, federal law has been interpreted by the courts to actually prevent states from verifying citizenship before you can get added to the voter rolls. So basically what you're asked to do is check a box saying that you are a citizen, and then based on the honor system, you get added to the voter rolls, and you can even vote without ever having to actually prove that you're a citizen and therefore eligible to vote in federal elections. So the SAVE Act flips that around and clears this sort of court-imposed reading of federal law as prohibiting states from verifying citizenship, and now says, actually, yes, every state, before you can register somebody to vote in a federal election, will have to obtain proof of citizenship from a voter. This is a very common sense measure. It's also extremely popular with over 80% of the electorate who think that you should have to prove citizenship before you can vote.
I would imagine, though, that there's some serious pushback on this to certain groups that would probably like the voting or the franchise just kind of open willy-nilly. Is that a fair way of looking at that right now? I'm just wondering what kind of pushback it's getting.
Well, it's getting the same sort of a pushback that you've seen from groups and politicians on the left for decades now as it relates to voter identification laws, for instance. You know, the very basic and also extraordinarily popular policy that you should have to show an ID before you cast a ballot to prove that you are who you say you are. The left has been saying that this is going to lead to voter suppression for a couple of decades now, that it's going to prevent millions of people from voting. And yet what we have seen in the context of voter ID is that actually turnout has increased. It's improved voter confidence in elections. And particularly in states that pass voter ID laws, you actually tend to see turnout bump up in the election that immediately follows. So we're seeing the same sort of concerns raised, arguments that the SAVE Act and proof of citizenship is going to prevent millions of people from voting. But I always caution people, you know, we've heard the same warnings for decades about voter ID, and it never came true. And that is absolutely going to be the case here with proof of citizenship. This is not going to stop anybody from being able to register and vote.
The bottom line, from what I understand, though, is that most people will turn out more if they believe that the election process is a bit more secure and that we're keeping people who aren't legally entitled to the franchise, keeping them from getting into the system. Because Oregon, like I mentioned when we first came on, admitted that there were several non-citizens that were in our voting rolls and they got registered by motor voter, right? This is probably not all that uncommon.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You've got numerous instances where because of this honor system that we use for proving citizenship, you've actually seen non-citizens get on the rolls and even cast ballots. And just within the last year, we've seen states like Virginia, Texas, Ohio, and Oregon acknowledge that they had non-citizens on their rolls. And state officials in many of these places actually said that some of those folks cast ballots. You know, the Michigan Secretary of State just last week said that non-citizens voted in 2024 in the state of Michigan. Every single one of those illegal votes by a non-citizen represents the voice of an American citizen who had his or her ballot canceled out by a non-citizen. And that's why this is so important. It's long past time for us to ensure that every person who is getting added to the voter rolls to participate in federal elections is a citizen, and that only citizens are voting in our country.
Jason Snead is the executive director of the Honest Elections Project Action. We appreciate you coming on talking more about this. What kind of identification would be then deemed acceptable for voting? And would this be for state elections or all elections or just federal elections? How does it control this?
Well, this would be for federal elections, and that's an important distinction here. You know, mm-hmm. Congress has a limited set of authorities when it comes to regulating elections. The bulk of election regulation authority rests quite properly under the U.S. Constitution with state legislatures. So if a state decides that it wants to avoid having to prove citizenship for state elections, it would be free to do so. But you would have to bifurcate your system, and you would have to have one set of rules that prove citizenship for federal elections and one set that does not for state elections. Now, what's important to note there is that right now the inverse is true. Because you've had this litigation filed by groups, essentially groups exclusively on the left, and courts have interpreted federal rules to prohibit states from proving citizenship, you now actually have the opposite dynamic where states have to decide, okay, do we want to have two separate systems so that we can prove citizenship for state elections, but we cannot do it for federal elections? I think it makes all the sense in the world to nudge states towards requiring proof of citizenship, and doing that for federal elections is a good way to start, but states would be free to do otherwise. In terms of IDs, any form of photographic identification that demonstrates citizenship, as well as things like a birth certificate, a passport, and so forth, as long as it establishes identity and citizenship. And it's important to note here, these are the same basic requirements that Americans already have to meet in order to get a real ID. So now we're just taking something that Congress decided we should be doing decades ago and applying it to voter registration in order to ensure that we have maximum security in that process.
All right. So real ID, the real ID deadline is early in May, too. As a matter of fact, I have to go get my driver's license renewed, and I have to bring all sorts of documentation to do this. Now, here is a fly in the ointment, so to speak, at least what I've received people writing with concerns about it. I see some news coverage on it. My wife has even wondered about this, as people who get married and have changed their names, and they don't have any source documentation that ends up showing that they had, you know, that this is an actual proper name that they're using. That's been some of the concerns brought up with this. Is there anything in the SAVE Act that helps ameliorate some of those concerns?
Well, yes. So the SAVE Act directs that states have to establish procedures for addressing those types of concerns. So somebody who has a proof of citizenship document, but the name on it doesn't match the name on the driver's license because they got married, for instance.
Right.
So states will have to establish a procedure for that. And, you know, look, the bottom line is here that in terms of the argument, this really is grasping at straws because there are millions of women who get married every single year and they go through the process of changing their names. It's relatively straightforward. It can be a headache, absolutely, but it's a straightforward process. Every state has a process for dealing with name changes. And look, also, if you are a married woman who has a job, you had to complete documentation like the I-9 form to prove citizenship. That's a legal requirement. So if you've cleared that, then you can absolutely clear this. This is not going to prevent anybody from getting registered and voting in our election system. And frankly, I'm a bit disappointed, though not terribly surprised, that this is the argument that's getting used, because what we've seen in the context of very popular measures like voter ID laws and proof of citizenship is that opponents of these measures know they are on the wrong side of an 80-20 issue. And so rather than admit that and have an honest debate on the merits of these bills, they prefer to try to scare people away using tactics like this. And these concerns, these fears, never pan out.
Has there been any Democratic support of this, or was it mostly passed with Republican votes? Can you tell us about that fate of the SAVE Act?
Well, only four Democrats in the House of Representatives voted for the SAVE Act.
Oh.
The overwhelming majority, 208 members, voted against this bill. And again, this proof of citizenship concept is an 80-20 issue with our public. So I think it's very clear who those members of Congress are listening to, and it's not the voice of the average citizen. Republican, independent, Democrat, black, white, Hispanic, doesn't matter. We all believe overwhelmingly that you should have to prove citizenship before you vote. And apparently the better part of 90% or more of the Democratic caucus in the House believes otherwise.
All right. Now, Oregon is a vote by mail state, Jason. Is there anything different about this for vote by mail states rather than vote in person kind of states? Or is it just, hey, you know, would the states have to example people who are registered to vote? Would the state have to go through this then and get us all recertified? How would that work here in Oregon, you think?
Well, one of the big impacts that you're going to see, particularly in vote by mail states, are some of the other requirements that are in the SAVE Act to clean up voter rolls. So we want to make sure not only that people that are getting registered are proving citizenship, but we also want to make sure that we don't have ineligible voters currently on the rolls. And so the SAVE Act does two things to help with that. One is it makes federal databases that track citizenship information available to states so that state and local election officials that have the responsibility to maintain clean voter rolls have access to that data, and they can use it to identify potential non-citizens on the roll.
But are the states required to use the database, though? Because if it's just a voluntary thing, I could see a state like Oregon maybe saying, well, you know, we kind of like it loosey-goosey, and then not do anything. What do you think?
That's right, and that's the second thing that the SAVE Act does. It puts new responsibilities and legal requirements on officials at the state level to actually use that record, those databases, and engage in list maintenance. And this is, you're absolutely right, this is a huge problem that we have seen for decades. Even though you already have federal laws that say states have an obligation to maintain clean voter rolls, many of them shirk that responsibility or actually are openly hostile to that. And there are numerous lawsuits filed against states to try to clean up voter rolls, alleging, you know, mass voter purges and so forth. It's all essentially designed to make it as difficult and as slow and as cumbersome as possible to actually clean up the voter roll. So the SAVE Act will improve that, and that will help every state. But the impact on vote-by-mail states will be that you're not going to be sending ballots to people that are non-citizens. You're not going to be sending ballots to people that are not supposed to be on the rolls, which obviously has implications in terms of the potential for fraud, but also is a waste of taxpayer resources, because every single person who is getting a ballot but shouldn't, that's an expensive thing that you have to print, you have to mail. There are costs that those add up. So there's a lot here to like, both from an election security perspective, from an anti-fraud perspective, and then also from the perspective of just being responsible with tax dollars.
Now, cleaning the voter rolls would be helpful. There are times, I know Dr. Douglas Frank has come into Southern Oregon, and he would talk about how, hey, you know, Josephine County has like 110% of eligible voters, you know, registered to vote. You know, in other words, more people registered in the databases. I don't exactly remember what the number was, but I'm sure you're aware of this kind of problem, that there are actually more people registered to vote than actually exist in the population in some cases because of keeping people that are inactive on it for a long time. Does the SAVE Act order states to change this situation that we have right now?
Well, the SAVE Act is a bit more limited in the sense that its focus is on non-citizen voting, but it will help to deal with that problem because, again, part of that situation is that people get registered automatically. Sometimes those people are ineligible or, you know, they'll eventually move. Either way, you've got this problem of a churn. You've got ineligible people being put on the rolls. You've got ineligible people not being taken off the rolls. So having access to new databases, having the requirement that new registrants prove citizenship, and then having the new legal requirements to engage in list maintenance will help to clean that problem up. It's not going to be a silver bullet, but there's no such thing. But every inch, essentially, that we can move in the direction of cleaner voter rolls is a worthwhile step to take, because that is really, truly the fundamental first step towards secure elections.
I really like that. Hey, Jason, good to hear about this. And how is it looking politically? Because I guess it goes to the Senate now. And do we have any idea, any prognostication about how it looks, or might it go through like it did in the House?
Well, I'm always a little hesitant to read the tea leaves, but let's remember that the SAVE Act was first introduced in the last Congress. It passed the House just like it did yesterday, and it died in the then Democratic-controlled Senate. Typically, legislation in the Senate needs 60 votes, which means that Democrats are in a position to kill the SAVE Act a second time. And if the vote in the House is any indication, I think we'll see overwhelming opposition from Democrats in the Senate. I think that they're going to throw as much chum in the water, including, you know, allegations that this is somehow going to prevent millions of people from voting. But I think the real question to ask is, you know, more than 80% of Americans think that only citizens should be voting and you should have to prove citizenship before you can register to vote. Why are Democrats opposing something that 80% of Americans, including a majority of their own voters, say should be the law? This is very common sense. And if we were actually listening to what the American people wanted, the SAVE Act would be passing with overwhelming bipartisan support, but it isn't. And I think it's time to ask why.
All right. Jason Snead, Executive Director of the Honest Elections Project Action. And what is your website where people can go to find out more about this and other election news?
HEPaction.org, or follow me on X at Jason W. Snead, or at Honesty Elections for all the latest on election integrity all over the country.
All right, Jason, really appreciate the take on it. Good to have you on. We'll have you back. And thanks for pushing this and making it move forward. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Jason Snead from the Honest Elections Project Action. It is 8:53 and change at 99.3 KBXG, 106.3 KMED. And we have a little bit of time for some open phones here to wrap up the show. We've had a lot going on this morning. If you wanted to weigh in, this is the time to do it. 770-5633. Appreciate you listening. Hi, this is Bill Meyer. Always appreciate you listening, no matter the time.
KMED.
And remember, Stan, the Roe Gardner Live, that's going to be a great show tomorrow out at the Grange Co-op White City. Good, good stuff going on there. By the way, Keith writes in and says, hey, Bill, big tie-up on Stewart Avenue over by Oakdale, so just be aware of that in Medford, okay? Let me go back to the phones here, and we're going to grab, let's see, Chuck. Hello, Chuck. How you doing this morning? Welcome.
Yeah. After listening to Kevin Starrett, how positive he was, I decided that Medford needs to have their Coliseum for the baseball, because where else are they going to put the conservatives and the Christians?
Oh, that's right. You have to have a place to have the Lions there ready to do a little muncha-buncha, right?
Right.
Oh, boy. I hope we never get to that point there. Do you think that the Republicans would be willing to walk out if it got to that point?
Yeah.
Okay. Chuck, I appreciate the call. Thanks for that. Yikes. Yes, we need a place to throw the conservatives and the Christians. Gosh, we can laugh about that only just a little bit, I guess. Brad, my brother, how you doing there from the SLM, Slovenian Lives Matter?
Hey, man, what you doing? I got some really, really good information from SLM.
Yeah?
We have people. We're a quiet riot. We're all over the place. We have some subcontractors that are working for Elon Musk over all these, you know, crazy dollars that are being spent in the federal government that are being exposed. Well, it turns out Anthony Fauci had a contract with Fish and Wildlife to develop a hybrid Bigfoot.
A hybrid Bigfoot? Really?
Yeah. This has been going on, and it's got a lot of money attached to it. And this is what's crazy. They've got game cameras in Oregon that have caught this thing.
Okay, then
never believe who it looks like.
Who does it look like, huh?
Jeff Merkley.
You know, after that last town hall, I might have to agree with you a little bit. He did look a little rolling out of there, big footy, okay? Appreciate the call.
You got it.
Thanks. Dale says, hey, Bill, grift, leave Elon alone. Leave Elon alone. He is not a grifter. The government set up subsidies for electric cars. He didn't. The government let contracts for rockets after they discontinued the shuttle. He's just responding to those contracts. Okay. I guess I just don't like them being held up, though, as paragons of capitalistic virtue. Okay. We'll talk more about the emails and stuff tomorrow. Email Bill at BillMeyerShow.com. Have a great weekend. See you Monday, okay?